Hello and welcome to Studio Sessions, the big red and shiny podcast where we talk with artists about the ideas, inspiration, and processes that go into their work. I'm your host Matt Kuhlman, and this episode I'll be speaking for a second time with Rob Andrews. This is the first time that I've had a repeat guest on the show. After our first hour-long conversation, I felt there was such a large percentage of Rob's work and ideas that we didn't even come close to talking about that I arranged a second meeting, this time accompanied by his collaborator and documenter, Ryan McManus. To recap, Rob's work often deals with rituals, historic social narratives, mythology, particularly the Minotaur, and creating situations where outsiders are compelled, either by their own will or prompting of the scenario, to intervene on the performance in some way. While it's not completely necessary, I would suggest listening to my first interview with Rob before listening to this one, as it is likely that this discussion will be more difficult to fully understand without that foundation. Join me as I continue my discussion with Rob and also gain some outside perspective on his projects from Ryan. Alright, so it's a little different where I'm usually just one-on-one with people, but since we got two people, I'm going to do a voice introduction. First, we got Rob, who I've already met with previously. Rob.
Oh, Matt, that was just ejecting some change. Hey, Matt.
How you doing?
Great.
And over here we also have Ryan.
Hey. Hi, how's it going?
Rob's collaborator and...
Mentor.
Mentor.
Yeah.
Mentor, sensei.
Yeah, that's right. He's I'm his Donatello. He's my splinter.
Yeah, I don't think you should take your belt off while you're saying
that. I just really need to loosen up.
To color in a little picture for the listening audience.
Yeah.
Anyway, as the newest addition to the conversation, we'll probably explore some of what you do first,
Sure. Ryan,
independently, and then how you began collaborating with Rob. So you brought along a book of your Instagram feed.
Yeah. Well, that was actually a gift to Rob for Christmas this year. I made it... Well, yeah, I don't know. I liked Instagram when it first came out. It was really an interesting technology, and I've always kind of been interested in how people share images online, so I started putting pictures up on there, and then somebody told me I could make a book, and I made a book. And I only made one, and then I gave it to Rob when I was done with it.
Can you do your thing? Can you give me your bio?
Sure.
Yeah.
My whole bio?
Yeah.
You know, Long Island boy.
Yeah.
World traveled.
There you go.
Chicago, Phoenix, Boston, where my allegiances lie, I'll say. Austin, Texas. Ended up back in New York. Returned home to the place of my parents' childhoods. And I work in the city. During the day, I'm a creative director for an internet company. So we make... internet sites, and then...
But you make shit. That's what you do. You're a maker. Ryan started as a product designer.
I say no a lot. That's my job, man. I have to say no to designers, and to say no to clients, and to say no to my boss, which is really great.
So when you say yes, is your job done?
Yes, I think once I say yes, I'm done for the day. Like, it's a series of no's, loud no's, punctuated by a quiet yeah.
Yeah.
Like, you know, because you're never really done. So, I guess I give in every once in a while.
So I'm going to take over. So Ryan, I met him, he was the roommate of one of my best friends. And my friend told me that he's a photographer, and that he had shot some soft porn.
Yeah.
And that was really interesting to me. Because I was like, you know...
It wasn't even soft porn. It was
proper porn.
It was like medium rare, I'd say. Oh, yeah.
There's a guy who I can, like, work with. Because he's got... His boundaries are wide enough and loose enough. And he came and shot this... I'm pointing at a piece. This is the first Minotaur piece, which was in... I don't even remember. 2004 or 2005? When did you live in Tampa?
2006.
2006?
Yeah. It was right after I moved to New York.
And on some level, like, the first Minotaur piece was the most narratively driven in a funny way.
It was
the most literal one. Yeah, so this was at Exit Art in New York City, and Jeanette Ingerman and Papo Colo had sort of given me... their whole thing was that they always sort of, like, turned their head about me. So I could sort of do what I wanted. And so I took a sort of hidden space and I bought, I was just talking about the state of my students. I bought like all, no, that was the time I had hay FedExed to me from a hay farmer in Iowa, which was awesome.
Oh, thank you.
It was really great. Yeah. It was very, very kind. And we constructed a space where the Minotaur lived, and I'm looking at this beautiful photograph. This is kind of the iconic Minotaur photograph. It's like a corral, and we sort of imagined the Minotaur in this space, stuck there and forgotten, and we sort of littered it with TV guides and this
shopping cart. There was a shopping cart, I remember.
And it was sort of barricaded in by a shopping cart, and visitors to the performance had to actually walk up a huge ladder and sort of peer over the top to see the Minotaur.
Okay.
And Ryan, like, that was the moment when I saw those photographs where I was like, okay.
And before that, like, I had come into this, and to Rob's point, I had been a kind of a part-time pornographer. Me and five friends had started a fairly successful indie highbrow porn magazine in Texas called Box.
Yeah.
And as a photo editor, I was in charge of, like, obviously, like, wrangling a lot of photographers, but, like, taking a lot of the photos myself. And I had justified the purchasing of professional-grade equipment for that. But photography had always been kind of a side gig for me. And then It's not a gig.
That's why you're special. Anyway.
Okay.
Right?
Fair.
Because you're about... it is about telling stories for you.
Yeah, photographing a performance is as close to you get. It's like a combination of photographing a news event and a wedding.
But I've had other people, if any of these photographers listen to this podcast, I'm sorry. But, like, you photographing a performance is completely different from anyone else shooting a piece. I can articulate it, most like, but, like...
You probably can more than I can.
Had you had people try to document your work before and...
When Ryan is, like, catskilling, or if Ryan is being flown to Europe to drive the brand new fucking Alfa Romeo or whatever, like, Ryan's also a super car enthusiast and writes for Cool Hunting... Like, he's a fucking Renaissance man. He's bananas. He's bananas, really. I mean, I can't even believe he's here, right? When other people shoot my work, it's adequate. I mean, it's adequate documentation. But Ryan, do you know, like, one time someone sat me down and described to me the really specific definition of the word disinterest, right? It doesn't mean not interested. It means not emotionally and I'll add, spiritually invested. Like, Ryan has this own, and he has, like, another engine, right? So, like, he lets me be what I am, but he also has his own whole metaphysical fucking thing happening. And when I look at the pictures, I recognize, I love his pictures like I love... like a David Foster Wallace short story. I see that and I'm like, it's not even like, I can't believe you shot my work like that. It's like, I can't believe that story is in the world.
So what he puts out is a so much more than just a documentation. It's like an extension of
I want to say on record that like this shit is not like I maybe make a drawing and I do the thing like I put my body in the world. I take a risk with my body, which is probably, you know, and I might create a set of circumstances that may or may not make art happen. But Ryan makes the art. Ryan, and I couldn't mean it any more that and this goes back, this is like a decade old long train of thought that like art and storytelling is about, to me, it's like about service. Mm. It's about servicing a narrative and servicing an audience, and like Ryan makes me humbler as a human than like almost anyone else, other than maybe my wife. truly, like, because this is who I like. This is who I like. I'm naked in front of. Not even literally. Yes, literally, and that's the performance art cliche, of course. But like, truly, you know. Mm. And I wish we could deliver the moments where, like, you know, I did this piece on top of English Kills. Excuse me, where I was on top of this big industrial building, and Ryan was on top of the roof, and we had our like confab over like how to shoot the piece and everything.
Yeah.
Mm. It's interesting. On the flip side, like, what's your experience of documenting his pieces then?
Yeah, I'll shut up. I'm sorry.
No, it's interesting because, like, we really, Rob and I have never really kind of talked about the theory behind how to photograph a piece. Mm-hmm. We'll talk through kind of, and I think partially because Rob's pieces have a, Rob becomes what he is doing so much that he can't really predict where it's going to go. There's an arc that it's going to follow, and we talk about the arc. Mm-hmm. We don't really talk about like specific moments. Mm-hmm. He's like, there are going to be things that I'm doing. Let's try to like make sure that those things are captured. But he's never kind of specifically directed me. And Rob and I have never really talked about my approach to it. Has always been one of my favorite movies is Wings of Desire, the Wim Wenders movie about angels in Berlin.
Do you know it, Matt?
No.
Where these angels
go
kind
see
of
that fucking movie. Anyone who ever listens to this, go see Wings of Desire.
If only to get a greater understanding of the genius of Peter Falk.
Holy shit!
I mean, it is
Columbo does something important. Finally.
And I know I'm going to come across as terribly pretentious in saying that, but
so I'm going to try to talk about post irony next. So
okay.
Bring it on.
All right, yeah, we'll build up.
Bring it on, bitch.
But the movie takes place in Berlin, and it's about these, it follows the narrative of these two angels who are just kind of observing the human drama that unfolds in front of them without actually being able to kind of manipulate or influence that. And like, I take that and kind of think about also science and nature, and like trying, the thing about,
they also go to a Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds concert.
Yes, they do. Yeah, Nick Cave is also Nick Cave and Peter Falk in the same movie.
Yeah,
it really sad.
That's like my that's like my fucking kind of alchemy right there.
Rob and I own the distribution rights on the DVD, which is why we're trying to push.
That's right.
We shouldn't have given that away.
No. Well, total transparency. But so, and when I try to photograph a performance of Rob's, I just, first of all, I'm driven by just abject fear of missing something. And I think like that gets back to what I was saying earlier about like being like a wedding. It's like photographing a wedding, and that those moments are never going to happen the same
way.
It's
bad for you, huh?
It's stressful. Like, sometimes I lose sleep about it.
I have eyes everywhere.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
I don't even think of you.
Well, and then the... I mean, from an equipment point of view, like, yeah. The photo, I'm pointing at this large-scale photograph that we shot on medium format.
Like, that photograph, so much pain, sweat, and power went into that piece.
And before I'd shot that, I never shot medium format more than a single roll. Like, it was like a borrowed camera. Like, there's so much built-in fear, especially with film. Mm-hmm. But
we raised $10,000 to shoot that picture.
Yeah.
That's it. I mean, it's
a single image, isn't it?
Well,
there's three of them. Okay. Yeah, yeah. But in terms of shooting it and framing it and producing it, we did everything the best that we could.
Yeah,
And I think it bears out. And we chose not to glaze it, so we didn't put glass over it. So that piece is a performance in and of itself. That object, it'll fade over time. The sun will destroy it.
The sun will destroy everything.
And that for $4,000, it's yours.
Three. You got yourself a
deal. Done.
We will throw in.
Done.
We'll throw in the Blu-ray, Wings of Desire. But anyway, so like. When I approach photographing one of these performances, I really come at it from the idea of me being an observer that is not in the audience. Mm. I'm like apart from both Rob and the audience, because really what's interesting is that space that's happening and the tension and electricity that's happening in between them.
But that's authorship.
Well, it's directorial authorship, I
guess.
Yeah, I think of myself not as the director, but the camera.
But you're yanking, not being yanked. I mean, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, well, and someone else who tried to do what he does, would read as be yanked.
Mm.
You know what I mean? And there's like, and that's like the ineffable quality of someone who's a fucking genius, right? Mm-hmm. Who like can take a mechanical process and give it a human skin on some level, right? And, like, that's what I'm trying to do as a performance artist, too. Mm. Or as a fucking artist, right? Like you take a story, and the story's just bones, right? And you throw the fucking bones on the ground, and you pour some blood on it. And then it becomes a prediction. You know, that's it, right? Like, that you take those photographs, and they're sort of predictive.
Mm-hmm.
Or right, they're
conjuring.
Like,
they're like,
yes,
they're
right. There's magic happening. There's like spirit magic happening.
Well, I think about the performance that you did in Union Square, the foot washing, the ritual cleanse, where Brian shot the video, and like
right.
My cousin Brian Cassidy is a director and
cinematographer, and Brian Cassidy and his wife Melanie Shatsky just.
Yes.
Made an incredible, incredible, incredible movie named Francine. And, like, if I could ever make a work with that sort of, like, emotional fidelity, like, I would, you know?
Well, and be truthful, that's my bar. Like, when I think
about it,
Brian has always been, you know, he was a photographer. He still is a photographer, but he started in photography long before I did, and, like, his sensibility has always informed my sensibility. So I think that, like, when I approach it, I think about how...
So, and let's do this now. Like, I'm going to do the thing.
Okay.
Like, I think... and so, like, when I came to New York in 2001, like, right after September 11th,
mm-hmm.
I was surrounded by people starting businesses, right? Like, a good friend of mine is Dan Stedman. He started the Elle magazine, which is sort of a New York thing.
Mm-hmm.
I was sort of part of these. I was part of a circle of people who were starting things, and we were all kids who went to school. I'm sure, like you, Matt. Like I didn't read Infinite Jest in college, but I read Ulysses, and I read what DeLillo book? White Noise.
Yeah.
Right, and we were sort of like brought up in this like. Pull it apart, peel it, talk about it, tattoo it on your fucking shoulder. You know what I mean? Like, really, like, be like, in order to be the thing that you thought that you knew you were destined to be, you had to like take slices of like 1,000 pieces of other people's incredibly rich cake.
Yeah.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
And like,
you gotta be knowledgeable on every single thing.
And, I mean, and
I still feel that compulsion.
Yeah. And like, it's like
influence.
Oh, yeah. Like the kid in the room next over is really into Derrida, so I gotta like, I
just like to be able to know all the references. Like, for instance, just a very small example.
Yeah.
Like, watching The Simpsons, like the creators were talking about, like,
but the Simpsons is like a Rosetta Stone for like, that for this fucking thing.
To get all the gags, like, you would need to have read like hundreds of books, like seen hundreds of movies,
totally.
Like, and there's just so many references that even like years later, I would like find out about something, be like, oh, that's what that gag was in The Simpsons, like, 5 years ago.
Well, because the writer's table is, like,
oh, yeah.
12 guys
from O'Brien.
Who, like, came up reading Pynchon.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, guys who are dreaming of getting blown by the frat girls.
I'm still getting references in Beastie Boys' Check Your Head. Like, I've been listening to that for, what, 20 years?
Yeah.
And I'm still like, oh, that's who Lee Dorsey was. You know, like, I'm just I mean, that was such a pre-internet thing where, like, rap music, you would just mine it for these all these references. And, and just try to find out more about them to because of that obsession of, like, learning more about influences.
And like, so, I guess to like, I fell in love with my wife. I mean, I loved her the first day I met her, but we really fell in love reading Infinite Jest, right? Like,
two-person book club.
We lovingly competed across Italy, like, fighting about Infinite Jest, right? And there's something about that time, like, that was 96, between 96 and 2000, so it was a 10-year period between those, you know, where I somehow gave myself an out from the critical swamp, you know what I mean, or whatever that competitive fucking minefield was, and I met Ryan, and I saw his work, and I was like, I think I feel confident enough to start making things and not giving a shit at all what context they may or may not fit into. Mm. You know?
Yeah, that's true. You kind of... And even since you've started the kind of... the, you know, I'm a comic book guy, so like I think about things told in arcs, story arcs. But the End of Empire arc that has started to inform your work... you have become more fearless about creating work and having that work destroyed and changing course and changing your mind. And I think that's actually one of the best things about working with Rob is that, like, he has the ability to change his mind about his own work, which is an impossibly difficult thing to do when you put so much sweat and love into a piece. To be able to destroy those things and tear down your own synthesis.
But also, I mean, and maybe this is just a mechanism for me to survive as an artist, but like part of it is to convince oneself that one is a vehicle whereby the story is told. Mm-hmm. Like,
and sometimes you're digging in,
like,
dirt, and sometimes
kill
you're
the author,
scab.
Right? Mm-hmm. Kill the fucking author. Like, I honestly, like, I was here, Ryan and I met, and I was here and I was working some of this stuff. There's like, we're sitting in my studio. There's a bunch of really, really disparate objects all over the walls. Well, Matt spent his day with real artists.
Right.
People who went to art school.
All this stuff makes sense to me now because I've already talked to you once, and so I see the Minotaur heads, and I've started...
These are vampires, man.
I started following you on Twitter, so I see these paintings, but what I am surprised about is I thought those were all, like, digital works, because, like,
A lot of it is digital.
Okay.
A lot of it's like me jamming on my iPad on my way to school.
But these are like real life paintings of...
This is like me, right? And like I come to the studio and like and I've convinced myself that I have the, I guess license to like make this story firmer. Mm-hmm. To firm
like
it up
on this one on the left here, you're using a fountain painting of like this nice scenic landscape.
Do you want to talk about it, baby?
Yeah, let's get into it.
Let's talk about it. Okay. So this painting that we're looking at right now is it's called Mr. and Mrs. Robert Andrews, and it's by William Gainsborough. Mm. the famous English portraitist. And these are my ancestors, quite literally.
Okay.
And it hangs in the National Portrait Gallery in London. And it's like, and I had another person over for a studio visit, and her jaw dropped because she saw the painting, and she was like, holy shit, like I spent 2 weeks of art school in London, like actually in the portrait gallery looking at this painting. Mm-hmm. And I'm sorry, for all the listeners, like I've defaced multiple versions of the image, so you can't really see it. But it's a really important image. It's an iconic image because Gainsborough was, in his heart, a landscape painter. He thought that, like, he thought his job was to document the land.
Mm.
I mean,
yeah, that's equally prominent to the figures in this.
More prominent, this chick who came to see my studio, she was like, she knew all of the social coding. Like the piece on the bottom, you can see there's all these things about like they're like sort of established bourgeois gentry, but there's all these little disses built
like
into it.
Very fey and
right, yeah. You like, sort of like his stockings are not clean and crinkled and all this shit. And so in my family, anyway, which was I would have been the, and I'll say it. I would have been the fourth Sumner Robinson Andrews at Harvard University.
Mm.
I come from I'm a Mayflower dude. You know what I mean? Like my family goes way back, and I didn't go to Harvard. I didn't.
It's never too late.
Yeah,
right. I could always go back.
Fulfill your destiny.
Yeah, that's right.
The horns will grow. Show up at Harvard.
I feel like I have some hasty pudding diarrhea. Oh! But so this painting was like, you know, like my family, without getting too dirty about it, is, well, there's this thing, right, in America, we don't know where we're from, on some level, right? And so this painting had, like, a particular power in my family. And a sort of perverted power. You know, like, we're important. Mm. We have some... I mean, and that shit... And, like, now that I teach... I teach, like, kids who are more disenfranchised than you could imagine... Like this is so perverted, you know. It's like difficult for me to even like approach, you know. And so, like on one hand, I take the Gainsborough painting and I treat it like, you know. I think I said this in the last time we talked, Matt. Like I feel like my job is to pollute, as an artist.
Mm-hmm.
And like and this isn't about me vetting my genealogy. This is about me polluting this like totally glacial narrative. You know,
mm-hmm.
Like I'm a white guy to just poor black kids, and I stand in front of them, and I like, I mean, it's impossible. I don't know how else to say it. It feels impossible.
Mm.
You know?
Yeah.
And like I feel like it's my job actually to like ruin it. To ruin myself on some level. And like I don't know any other way. If I could harm myself. Mm-hmm. You know, like this is how I have to do it. This is how I have to tell the right story.
Mm. And I guess where did the story go from the time that this painting was painted? Like, what era? Was it like 1700s or so? Like, it looks like a 1700s painting.
Yeah. I mean, it's pre-American independence.
Once your family came over here, like, what kind of... Did it separate from that route fairly soon after coming over here? Or did you research that much? I'm not sure.
No. Well, my grandfather died, and he was the genealogist.
Uh-huh.
And also, there was sort of... It's not important, but there was, like... My grandfather was sort of the caretaker of the story. And I lost the ability to connect with him at a certain point. But anyway, like, that's... that's important anyway, because it's about revision anyway,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, that's where we live. Like, we live in a revisionist culture. We live in, you know what I mean? Like, you can... So I've, like, I feel like this is, like, a little scrap. And it's important, and it has power, because it's mine.
Mm.
But actually, like, the more I pollute it, and the more I throw it out into the world, the more it's yours.
Mm.
On some level.
You're giving it up.
Offering it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Like,
yes.
This is a part of me.
Yeah, yes. And the great thing about it is that this is maybe not that interesting, but, like, this is like a... Like a digital printing company in Kansas City, that
KC baby,
yeah. That does like weird inkjet printing on canvas,
mm-hmm.
And I think it was like $70 a print,
yeah.
You know, and I'm a fucking public school teacher and I've got two little kids, you know, like that was a major investment for me,
mm-hmm.
And so I like pinned it up on my studio wall and I was like, I am gonna fucking destroy this thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but no, I'm not going to light fire to it. I'm going to, like, make my ancestors vampires.
Yeah. Metaphysically destroy it, not physically.
The National Portrait Gallery is now on alert.
I know! You asked me that. You're like, why don't you go to the National Portrait Gallery and actually do it?
I think I actually said, please don't. That is not the end of this story.
Well, it's great. And as we're sitting here in the studio, there's three different versions of the piece.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote on one of them that's actually laser printed on fancy paper, anatomy. So I'm trying to define the anatomy of this sort of like archetypal vampire.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting to me.
And I guess in some of these other digital pieces that I was seeing then that are similar to this, like what are some of the same scenes that you're painting these chaotic vampires in that are screwing up the narrative? Because I think there was one that was like a performance of yours or something. It was a gallery setting, it looked like. And
oh yeah, yeah.
It was
you shot that piece, right? Like the that was. That's interesting. I think that's like worth talking about. You shot the piece where Danelle was being cleaned. I can't remember the name of it now.
Yes.
It's like kind of glorious to reach a point in your career where you can't remember the name of your performances. It was
public.
Doesn't matter. Look,
yeah.
I did a piece where I can, and it'll come to my mind. I did a piece where I convinced people, Craigslist people, and some friends to strip down naked in a gallery.
Mm-hmm.
And it was called Assembly,
Clean Assembly.
No, right. Just Assembly.
Just Assembly.
Assembly and I convinced strangers to offer their bodies up to be cleaned, and it was amazing. And it's this whole it's also this like echo of the Craigslist sex ads too. Like,
no.
All these guys had made email handles like nycnakedartistguy@gmail.com, and I love the guy
professional naked. Yeah,
it was amazing. And these guys all. Like, I got all these incredibly enthusiastic responses, and I filled English Kills Gallery with all these bodies, and then let the public come in and clean their bodies, and some really incredibly invasive things happened. Go ahead.
Insanely.
Can you tell the story?
As the witness, what happened?
Yeah, well, I mean, you were part of the performance.
Right.
You were like me as my role and observer. So there were some performances where the public would clean certain anonymous members of, of Rob's group that have come from Craigslist. And there was one lone male who had become aroused while he was being washed, and he was nude. And
get the fuck out of here! I didn't even know that.
I didn't know.
Really?
Yeah, he was the one beside you, actually. But like, people would wash his feet, and as they were washing his feet, he would get a slow erection. And it was a cold room.
So he's a foot guy.
It was beyond cold.
It was retarded.
And
the room was laying on these thin sheets on concrete slab.
Oh my god, they were laying in garbage bags!
And, yes, in garbage bags, right. And then there was another member of the public, this woman who came in and watched another woman. She washed her vagina so
vigorously.
It took her 45 minutes. Only that. It so vigorously and so, like,
she got in
completely
there.
That's beyond washing.
It was, like, ritualistic. And this woman, the volunteer is the wrong word, performer, mm-hmm. I'll say, performer.
Yes.
Just stayed motionless, eyes closed throughout the entire experience while the stranger just...
She allowed a woman to clean the inside of her vagina.
Yes. With a rag out of a mason jar with warm water. I don't remember if she was blindfolded or eyes closed, but she was not interfacing with this person at all.
Right.
It was fascinating. It was really, really interesting.
And I was completely unaware, and I can't even remember who told me or how...
I think I probably told you afterward, or there were photos actually.
But this is also, and you've missed a few of these pieces. But like, there's this moment where I've done group pieces where I've had a bunch of people doing something for me, and this has been the best, where they all get together in the back of the gallery, or they get together in the back of the park, and I walk in and I realize I'm almost sort of interfering.
Right. It's like,
you know
a
what
rap,
I mean? Yeah,
it's like a rap party and you're the director.
They're just like, and you know, and this woman, and I won't name her, she was like, no, it's okay. I'm fine with it. And they were like, oh, honey. And I walked in and everyone was quiet. And I was like, what? You know, and I got all like mother henny about
yeah.
it. You know?
Well, you're very protective. You're very like, especially of the people who are
right, I would have gone out and like, kicked that person's ass.
Right. Like, the people who are willing to give up their, like, kind of, like, to become part of your performance.
Right.
Like, I think about the performance you did in the park in the East Village.
Where in Washington Square Park.
There's a plastic Minotaur mask behind Rob in the same kind of blue-gray as mm-hmm. his mask. And he invited people to wear those and just kind of, he performed as a Minotaur in the park while others wore the mask and did their daily kind of things. And people, two of our friends, just tossed a football back and forth wearing the masks.
Yeah.
And people became very aggressive with them, like violent, physical, like
because
they wouldn't respond, you know, they just were in the performance.
And I was hit by skateboards, a bunch of kids.
Yeah, that's something that I was wondering about, was like, in looking at the documentation online, I had no idea that he was getting his ass kicked on a regular basis during these performances.
Yeah.
And you were talking about like trying to see like every single aspect of it, and I know you probably have documentation of that, and like what's it like documenting while it's happening, and I'm sure it was just like you chose not to like put that out there as the documentation.
I don't know if you
there. I mean, I was there when you performed outside of Grace Space, one of the earliest performances we did together collaboratively, when that girl was throwing things at you. You were chained up as a Minotaur outside the gallery.
The day before Max was born.
The day before your son was born. I have a fantastic photo of Rob in his Minotaur mask in the back, getting into his Dodge, where his wife was driving.
my dilated wife,
driving you home. I mean, very candidly for me, it's a stressful experience because... first of all, I'm protective. It's not anonymous.
Me.
I also like I'm a controlling person. So my desire to interfere, not in simply just the violent kind of like inappropriate interactions that a lot of the audience members feel compelled to do to turn it into their performance, right?
Mm-hmm.
But just simply the people who are just incorrect. Like, that probably gets me more than anything.
Yeah.
Like, I remember the blood draw, also at Grace. Was that Grace? Yeah.
Yeah. Did I give you blood, by the way? I did, right?
You didn't, but honestly, I don't want your blood. Nothing personal. But...
fuck off. Really?
I don't want blood in my possession.
So we're going to... that's the last item. That's the last item we're going to talk about tonight on Mike.
But I watched... this nurse, Rob as Minotaur, tied down to a gurney.
That was really intense.
A nurse drawing his blood into vials.
Quite a bit of blood.
And then a huckster coming out and trying to sell Minotaur blood to the crowd, highest bidder. And after it was all said and done, Rob was laying there with the rubber tie still on his arm.
Yeah.
The huckster is gone, the nurse is gone, the audience is still kind of... And one of the greatest things about, for me anyway, as the observer role, one of the greatest moments in the performance is when it's done. But the audience doesn't
know... That was totally by design.
If it's done.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah, this like you let... It's kind of like... You build the structure and then you pull the structure out and all of the kind of dust is still floating in the structure shape and wondering if it's okay to collapse.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember
that's
this,
when the art happens.
Right. Mm-hmm. The audience, and we've talked about this before, the audience is really where the kind of interesting things happen.
I mean, it's even a misnomer to call them the audience. Like,
right.
Like
they're participants.
So, like, you do this thing, right? I did this thing. I hired a nurse to take my blood. And then I asked a guy to try to sell the blood. And all of that to me is like dangerously and uncomfortably close to theater.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Probably as close as you've gone.
Definitely, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And by the way, I wrote a script for Raphael that he didn't follow at all.
Oh,
and Sanchez, if you're hearing me... And I knew, and I told the guys that carried me out, I said, don't leave me out there for like half an hour or 25 minutes or something. Because I think that's when something interesting is going
to
happen.
And true to form, it did. Because like some brash young member of the kind of gathered crowd walked up and started handling the syringes and the vials.
Right.
And people like, don't touch that. The others were like, don't touch it. Don't. And he's like, it's fake.
It's all fake.
Uh-huh.
Even though it happened in front of them.
Right.
And it was
this weird, like, social contract between him and now he stood up and all of a sudden the crowd was paying attention to him. And like people were like chiding him not to do it. And he was going to do it. And like that was, I mean, all of that. And that for me, because I wanted to be like, No, honey, it's real.
Did you say anything?
No, I didn't say
anything.
I wanted to say something so badly, back to my like kind of wanting to correct.
But instead,
I just took pictures of him like trying to pick up bloody objects that he shouldn't have been touching.
And someone stole the syringe.
Yes.
Someone stole the syringe.
It was anarchy. That show was anarchy.
Right. Well, I mean, that's sort of the tone. Like, this was part of the Maximum Perception show at English Kills, so there's sort of a, like... I don't know. There's like sort of like a performance artist, like free for all on some level. But
yes.
But I don't know. Look, I have some small amount of pride that like I even I feel like I punctured that.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of the people in the audience were saying like, "What's going on? Is this real?"
Do you find that the audiences at group shows, especially for performance group shows, is more chaotic? Or less maybe predictable than the shows when you're just doing a performance?
Oh, so like a group show of
like
multiple
performances? There seems to be, and people coming in and out, like especially if it's part of the larger kind of art happening in Brooklyn or New York.
Yeah, I mean we could, like the expectations of an audience member of multiple performances... I'm trying to think. It's like almost like going to a freak show.
Yeah, I was going to say.
I hate saying it.
I was going to say Coachella, but freak show is
yeah.
Yeah, you're like, I'll dip in.
I can sort of like take what I want from this and then bounce.
Right. And my reverence is not needed because no one will remember me. Like, it's not like you're not like a participant. You're more of a kind of casual observer.
Right.
I mean, from me, from my perspective of, like, the shows that you've done that have been much more, like, collaborative as far as, like, being part of a larger event or show or more multiple performances.
Well, let's talk about MoMA. I mean, like,
you shot
both pieces.
Mm-hmm.
And, like...
That was my coin.
Yeah.
I'm voting loud objects to podcast. Sorry, this is a coin that... Was minted.
I noticed it's a half dollar.
It's a Eisenhower dollar that was minted the year I was born that my father gave me.
Does it go everywhere?
No, I've always had it.
Ah.
It's something that I just I get fidgety, so I have to worry an object, so I'm just kind of flipping it around.
And you're just using worry as a verb in that sense to be fucking literary.
Well, I've been listening to a lot of Blues Explosion.
Yes. the MoMA thing was like, Ryan shot two pieces. One of them was in this like totally sterile MoMA space, and then the other was in a theater.
Mm-hmm.
And they both
packed theater,
and they both had a sort of grandiosity that we hadn't encountered before on some level. But also they had like when I look at the documentation or when I like relive those pieces, in a funny way they're the most pedestrian stuff we've done.
They're the quietest.
They're really quiet.
There's
That's
something like
put,
intimate
yeah.
and quiet and like very I actually think they were the most approachable in a way because they're human, they were like tender, they were almost they're very vulnerable, especially the one in the gallery space where you were singing.
Yeah, I sang to a dead coyote.
Mm-hmm.
And I sang a Richard Farina and Mimi Baez song, like an old folk song.
And you actually had someone playing a guitar.
I had like people sit in.
Yeah, it was almost like, I mean, it had this feeling of like, I think tenderness is the word that comes to mind. Like, it was very like, it was
Which
sweet.
Was so, and there was something amazing that happened in that performance too. Martha Wilson, who runs Franklin Furnace Archive, which is sort of like a performance art institution in New York City, she was guest teaching a class, I want to say at the New School. And so she brought all these like young performance artists to the piece. And I was an intern for her back in like 1996, and like we go way back, you know. I applied for the Franklin Furnace Grant for 9 years and finally got it on like the 10th try, you know. Like I have a long, beautiful history with Franklin Furnace, and it was really interesting to have the energy of those kids. And I'm sure you can maybe even in your memory go back, like they were sort of like unwilling participants.
Yeah, but like
until they were willing,
mm-hmm.
straight fucking up, they were like.
And some of them, it took like only took you taking their hand for the switch to be flipped.
Right. So yeah, and at that point in my work, I was able to cross that bridge and take someone's hand.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
Which is and this is where I've wanted to go all night.
Mm-hmm.
And I sort of mentioned it before.
You're not taking hands like that.
I'm not. I love Ryan. But I love the way that he tells stories because I think we're telling stories in a really similar way.
Mm.
Which is very earnestly.
Mm. Oh, for sure.
And very honestly.
And hard on your sleeve.
Post-ironically?
Yeah, sincerely, I think. I mean, post-ironically, I equate with sincerity, maybe.
Right, and that's like a total dick word. I mean, like...
you just wanted to get it in there. That's
I mean,
awesome.
There was my curveball, baby. Like, I think there's like something about Ryan's work, and there's something about Ryan's story, and the way that he presents himself that is like... We both have heard the same jokes.
Yeah.
And we've both read the same books. And we've both...
we're corny in the same way.
And we're also sort of competitive. Like, we don't talk about it.
No.
That. But, like, if Ryan mentions something that I don't know, I look it the fuck up. You know what I mean? It's like a big deal, actually.
You guys ever wrestled before?
No.
Not yet.
It was interesting because
Ryan was a wrestler.
We were both wrestlers.
I was a wrestler.
You were?
Yeah.
We were talking.
He was
about
a fucking
that.
Midwest wrestler.
Oh yeah. So was I. To be fair. Illinois.
Oh, that's not the Midwest.
Yeah, they got some corn fed boys out in Illinois.
Of course I was an import from
from Long Island. You started by saying you're from Long Island.
But when Rob did a performance piece that was based around the idea of wrestling with our dear friend Eric.
Yeah.
That was the one we did.
It's now in New York City. Principal!
Yeah.
Get fired, baby.
Blow up everybody.
Yeah.
And I was supremely jealous of Eric to have that opportunity.
Really? Yeah,
I mean,
because I destroyed him like 5 times in a row.
And I'm sure you would do the same to me.
Well, he might. He looked
I
like
actually don't think I would. I think you're stronger than you look.
Well, I hope so. But I think that would be the only piece that I would be a willing participant in. Like, I think, like, there's something about our working relationship and our roles that I feel is, like, sacred. And
yes.
I can't be a performer in the pieces because...
I would actually refuse you.
Yeah. It would change things.
On some level. I love you.
Well, I think we should do it without any sort of audience. It's in a dark closet.
Right.
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 Just well, settle things.
This piece was one that we didn't talk about last time, so do you want to run down quickly like what you were doing with that piece?
The wrestling piece?
It was called a...
Grappling Door?
Grappling Door, so... It deals with the void that you were talking about with last time, I assume, but...
Yeah, yeah. So the, you know, like, wrestling... Wrestling's a dying sport. We talked about this a little
ancient.
Bit. Ancient. Wrestling's an ancient dying sport, and it's this... perfect act where you want to destroy someone as much as you want to care for them on some level, right? Like everything about it is designed to completely arrest someone, right? But at the same time, the fragility, like it's a fragile experience. Because you're really competing. I mean, like, you're...
Well, and you also have no opportunity for personal ego. Because
and
to arrest them,
of,
you have to...
It's a form of lovemaking. I mean, it's really bananas.
You have to embrace them so fully, and you're, for whatever reason, dressed so simply.
Yeah.
That you just have to, like, give up all pretense of, like, kind of social dynamic with that person and be like, I'm going to put all of my body on you so I can beat you.
Yeah.
Well, throw a little kink in it. One of my junior high coaches described getting pinned as being raped. And he's like, think about it. Like, your body's being forced into a position that you don't want it to be in.
Right.
And
that would...
Kind of like getting raped.
Well, just like, I'm so embarrassed. Like, I really want to, like... I want to remember this kid's last name. I just remember his first name, but... He was from Scotch Plains, New Jersey, and I wrestled him 3 times for 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I won the first time, I think. He won the second time. And we came up together. His name was Pat. I wish I could remember his last name. We were both like 215. We wrestled 215. And I realized that I loved him on some level. And there's also something about, like... I mean, I don't know what it was like for you guys, but like for dual meets... There was like one unbelievable light whose circle was circumscribed over the wrestling perimeter.
Yeah, the circumference of the perfect.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, and in my town anyway, I mean, the fucking bleachers were full. And my girlfriend was there. And shit. You know, I mean, it was crazy. I've never had that kind of... focus on my performance in the other sense, right? You know, I mean, like, and Pat and I, and we were both big guys, so we were trying to throw each other, and we were trying, and I just, there's something about wrestling that I think opens a door on some level. You know, I think, like, that negotiation between two people, and it's not obviously not about who wins and who loses, it's actually about the negotiation.
Mm-hmm.
Right, that we're able to do that. I mean, that's the.
Yeah. It's not about like physically like kicking their ass. It's about controlling the other person.
And so I'm gonna. So here's the second curveball. I've planned curveballs for my collaborator and my dearest friend. I feel like my job as an artist is to go back to Plato's cave, right?
Mm-hmm.
The first time that someone saw
a projection of themselves and named that as self.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
And that, and on some level, the dance of wrestling, like, is like a clear physical articulation of that, where you're like, I'm other than me. Like, in this communion, I am other. Right? And, like, I feel like my job as an artist is to go back to Plato's cave and, like, roll a grenade in it and run away.
Blow the fire up.
That's totally.
Yeah.
Like, that, like, the moment that the first hairy cross-eyed monkey, you know what I mean? Like, looked at a wall and saw its own shadow and said, I am a person. I don't know what it is. Like, I want to take that moment and unweave it on some level. Like, and that's what this work is about. I mean, that's what the Minotaur is about.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of the balance. Disrupting the balance. Giving it back to the beast. On some level. Because I'm sick of being a man. It's too much work.
Damn straight.
It's unnatural. It's terrible.
It's an ill-fitting suit.
It's bit, I'm wearing a man suit.
Yeah.
I walk around every day and I'm wearing this fucking man suit and it's not an option to take it off.
No.
So I have to tell stories about excising it, removing it, peeling it off. It'd be so much easier if we could just kill ourselves.
But isn't that what... Well, I don't want too fine a point on it. I don't like defining things. But, like, are you more you when you're performing than when you are not? Like, it's Rob Andrews standing and talking to teens more the Rob Andrews than the Rob Andrews who is painted and screaming at the crowd? You know? which one is... Or are both?
Yeah.
I'm trying to answer for you. I shouldn't do that. That's fine.
Same story, but I have a new therapist.
Mm.
And she's trying. I've tried to deliver my whole story to this therapist. And therapy's a weird thing, you know, where you're sort of like paying someone to be your best friend. You're paying someone to approve.
Uh-huh. To love.
And so they do. Indeed.
I'll do it for less money.
Right? Yeah, man, you just have to drive down to New York City. It doesn't work on by phone. But
being a woman helps, too.
Being, actually, you're right. It only can be a woman.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry that that's on tape, but it's just...
No, it has to do with dynamic. It has nothing to do with sex.
Right, right. But she sort of like... She's very forgiving and she's very lovely and she's like trying to figure me out in like a couple of I keep telling her stories, you know. And she said, some people would say that you're manic. Some people would say that you're an artist. And I think those two things are the same. Right?
Why make a distinction?
And I know that sounds like romantic and shitty and whatever, but like, and I don't, I mean, like, it's totally unpleasant to be both. Or, like, I sat there last night and I talked to her and I was like, sometimes I feel like I'm, like, cycling 1,000 times in a room to, like, other people's 100 times. Like, on some level. And that doesn't have anything... There's, like, nothing pejorative about that at all. Period. But, like, it has to do with stimulus and response. You know what I mean? Like, there's something really fucked up about the way that I, like, absorb and suck in. You know? And so, like, am I more me when I'm performing? It does feel like I'm resting on some level. You know what I mean? Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. I do. Yeah.
I feel like I'm sleeping. Like, I don't sleep that well. I'm not a good sleeper. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, I'm... Like, I feel tired every day, all the time. But when I'm performing, I actually feel like I'm resting. Mm-hmm. And when I'm done, I feel like I want to eat a hamburger. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
It makes sense. You're just talking about getting old. We're both getting old.
I guess so. I mean...
You feel tired, but you don't know why. You feel tired, but not sleepy, and then you get rest from doing things other than sleeping, I guess.
Get rest for... Yeah.
Rest and sleep aren't the same things.
You know, yeah, I mean, I think it's maybe about seeking nourishment on some level. Mm. Like, and when you put yourself in a circumstance, like, and Ryan and I both do this in different ways. Like, Ryan's a creative director. You're making things every day, all the time. I'm a teacher. I'm making things all the time, every day. Mm-hmm. And those things inevitably involve people.
Yes.
Like, people are the most important variable in the equation, even though I wish I could get rid of them.
Yeah. So much easier.
Well, the project that I wanted to touch back on was the video game project that you were doing. What's the progress on creating your video game? It's just to recap, it's like a real-time space of the United States or the world, one of the two, but running around as the Minotaur in this post-apocalyptic wasteland, and it's populated by nodes that are Flickr images or like uploaded mobile images of that people have taken and tagged in various locations, right?
The imprints of humankind.
Mm. Yeah.
I mean, I think, Ryan and I sort of we meet like twice a month with this other guy who's an incredible interaction designer, and we're moving closer to building a prototype for the space, which hopefully will be the catalyst for a really successful Kickstarter campaign. so we can raise the money to afford, like if you think of a game like, what are those games? Like the shooting drug games.
Like Vice City?
Yeah.
Yeah, Grand Theft Auto.
Yeah.
Imagine that.
Everywhere. Like those have like 100 designers.
Yes.
And interaction designers, and like we need.
If anyone at Rockstar is listening, I mean, you got some spare cycles.
This is amazing. I feel like we're talking to the world, and it's
hopefully.
Yeah.
No, I mean our ambitions are large. We started out with the idea that we would create a simulacrum of the entire world.
Yes.
With representative structures of urban, suburban, forest, field, coast, and you would be able to wander in real time forever and absorb and interact.
Sort of like a video game Beckett experience.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I was just hearing about this guy who's going to wander for the next 7 years in the path of human migration from the Rift Valley in Ethiopia down to Patagonia.
That's hard.
By foot. Yeah.
Which route would he take? Would he go
up through Asia and then across the... The only time he's not going to be walking is across the Bering Strait.
Does he have a PR agent?
He was on NPR this morning, so I'm sure he does.
He does!
He's a journalist. But that, I mean, the idea
Did
came out
of... You catch
me
sucking my tongue?
Yeah, you want to do it right into the microphone.
Yeah.
We have a soundboard for that.
Yeah.
But the, yeah, the idea was... I think the end result will be something that is akin to our original idea. In whatever... I mean, it's an abstraction, right? Like, everything that we create is kind of an abstraction.
Yeah, and I think what's interesting about it is that, like... And I Ryan and I met the other day, and we played a lot of games, or we took a lot of looks at different games. And so, like, games are... And I... Please cut me off. Like, games are... fake life.
Right. Well, they create... I mean...
And I'm interested in the epistemological, like, possibilities of saying that, like, actually, games are real life in another direction. Blah, blah, blah.
Well, there
blah,
are
blah,
very...
Blah.
I mean, there are myriad
right.
examples of,
right.
of games...
Games are better than jerking off. Games are better... Like, games are amazing. Like,
my life in World of Warcraft is more important than my
yeah,
life.
Yeah, I wear a game like a mask, and I'm gonna die and not eat
right.
all that shit, but...
Yeah. Well, we got into the whole Second Life conversation last time.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. Yeah.
Second
yeah,
Life,
yeah.
World of Warcraft. Rob and I are both fans of the game Shadow of the Colossus.
Yeah.
Just because it tells such a simple story and an emotional story in such a grand scale. And I think that's something that... and, you know, you cut me off if I step over my bounds. But I
yeah,
think
yeah.
that... the thing, calling it a game is a misnomer, right? It's
I
like
agree.
We're using the technology that allows you to create an artificial world landscape that video games have pioneered
right.
to create an experience where all players are performers and there is no audience.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so, Matt... Like, if nothing else is communicated in this piece other than this, like, I think Ryan and I, like, our mutual goal as humans is to create new forms.
Yes.
Right, like, I actually think that's what art is about.
Mm.
Right, and I think, like, we've identified the potential for a new form. Right? There are video games, and I'm going to use the words.
Sure.
Right? That have sort of, like, delivered an emotional package.
Yes.
That's compelling and powerful.
Yes.
However, like, you know, like, go... I don't know. Like, what's... I have kids, so I haven't seen a movie in a theater in a long time. But, like go see Lincoln, and you get to have that feeling. You know what
mm-hmm.
I mean? But I think the way in 10 years... I think the way that my son is going to experience transcendence and narrative is going to be through video games.
Yeah,
and
I
so like
that
I'm interested in making that form.
Yes,
like I want to, and it's not maybe it is competitive. I don't know, but I think that's my job as an artist is to like, or maybe that's my job as a person is to like,
well,
gain a little traction. Yeah.
What 10 years ago? Barney made Cream
Leisure
Master.
Suit Larry. Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry, you're talking about Matthew Barney. Excuse me.
Leisure Suit Barney.
Yeah.
No, I mean, Matthew Barney created this, and I mean, it's an astounding work using the most popular
medium
of the time. What Rob and I are trying to do is get ahead of the curve, I think, a little bit.
Sure.
I mean, I think
it's uncomfortable to say that on some level, but
it is. But like, if you look at games like BioShock, and you look at games like Echo, you look at what the guys who created BioShock are doing now. Like, they are trying to, like, there are these glimpses of what this kind of immersive narrative world can do. And
which is what? What's the ultimate goal? Proxy?
Yeah, I think emotional proxy. Right now it's physical proxy.
My life sucks, I'm fat, my
right.
wife doesn't fuck me.
Right, I'm going to go...
Well, it's also kind of the realm that film is going into, kind of Avatar was sort of the milestone of like these immersive experiences where
the narratives that we're consuming are about putting on a suit that's not a man suit.
Yeah. Well, it's like not even really like these movies aren't necessarily about like good narrative. It's about creating a space to go into.
It's an escape.
Like, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. An environment.
A fantastic little escape.
And you can also kind of follow a parallel of video games and movies crossing paths where video games become more cinematic, where there's all these like
let's talk about this for a second about how fucking limited we are as consumers, at least this is right now that in anticipation of this project that we're working on, I've been playing a million different games, and I've been playing Final Fantasy IV, which is by all standards like a terrible game. I mean, it's like a game of the 90s, right? Mm-hmm. But they recently reworked it for the iPad. So I played probably the first quarter of the game. And with the worst graphics and the most awkward play, I completely believed it. I fell in love with the characters. Mm. I was turned on by Rosa, the love interest. It takes nothing to make us into it.
Well, like, Final Fantasy VII is one of my favorite games ever, and that's...
And that's, like, hot shit, right?
Yeah. Well...
What did you play it on?
That was on the original PlayStation, so... It came out in, like, the mid to late 90s. Yeah.
Oh, so Final Fantasy IV is like...
It was before that. It might have even been like one of the Japanese releases.
It seems like that. I mean,
my friends are like Perfect Dark. You know, Perfect Dark.
The fucking music is like great, like so Jap, like soap opera. Like, it's amazing.
Like, just you saying that, about the love interest, like, in Final Fantasy VII, the love interest in that one dies. But I've just heard, everybody's story who's played that game him. Where they play it and they're like, yeah, when Ares died, like, I teared up. And, like, I even felt that, like, strong tug when she died. Because it was, like, you'd spent hours and hours and hours with this character, like, running around with them. And, like, you knew
what her dying. She played.
And then, like, she dies so suddenly in the game that
you
like,
can't stop her from dying. It's not possible.
No,
to
it's part
the
of the game.
Game. Huh.
That's what has to happen. It's fate.
It's fate. You're like fucking brainwashed.
She had to die.
It's, you know, it's fate. God made it happen.
No, it's like
the Final Fantasy gods.
It's like a part in the game where it's like, you know, the cutaway cinematic movie where she dies in the story. That's how it goes. You can't have her beyond that point. And you
can't correct it.
No.
But in a way...
But it's really interesting how those situations can have such a strong emotional attachment to the user, I think, where...
Well, because, like,
I mean,
because like all we want to do is escape.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we just want to get out of our skin. We just want... I mean, Christ almighty. You know? Like, I watched Captain America last night, and I was like... this is just like... The wimp kicks the sand on the bully, and I just.
By the way,
my grandmother bought me
that?
Archie Digests my whole life, you know?
Betty or Veronica? Were you going to ask that?
No.
I don't want to step on any toes here.
So I've actually gotten myself in trouble in my relationship by saying Betty.
Well, that makes sense.
My wife is like, listen, motherfucker.
I just say balls.
At the same time.
That's pretty good. It would never happen at the same time.
I don't know. I've seen some lewd drawings on the internet that indicate I'll forward them to you in an email.
I think we're nearing a good closing point for this conversation. But
final questions, Matt. Come on. Hit me hard.
Oh, I don't have any for you. Do you have any for me?
Yeah, I have a question for you, Matt.
Uh-huh.
So, like, you have been visiting different artist studios for, I mean, it, like, you have this project, and I kind of don't understand it on some level. Like, what compels you to do this project, and how different, what have you learned?
How was your summer vacation?
Yeah. But I mean, you're sort of, like, getting this, like, weird, intimate look at people, you know?
Yeah, it's a very long-term, intense project, especially the way that I do it, where having
what's wrong with you?
Especially having to work around a job that isn't this, like,
yeah.
I need to take time out of my schedule to, like, make it the most efficient use of time possible, so I'll do a whirlwind like this, where I'm at the tail end right now. This is technically the last. I've got one in a couple days because I got to reschedule, but this is the tail end of 3 days of 12 interviews, and so it's mentally and physically just like wears you out, just changing gears all the time, trying to keep up with like where people are at and like what's going
artists
on.
Artists are such sons of bitches.
Breathe. Well, I mean, you want to talk about herding cats? Like,
yeah.
Try to schedule 12 people in 3 days. And,
oh my god!
When they can all meet, and I make it work out somehow. But it's yeah. If you want to talk about like what have you learned from it, it's like, oh man, it's an experience.
Do you have like a gestalt like read on the creative personality or something?
No, not at all, because it's all over the map. You know, like
yeah.
And I really make an effort to try to branch out and not stay like genre specific or like just people that are specifically
you're all over the place, like you're seeing all different kinds of artists. Yeah
it's like those people I've interviewed who I personally didn't find their work that appealing, but it raised questions.
Go fuck yourself, man.
I didn't say you were in that.
Alright, okay, fine, fair enough.
But people who like if I just saw their work in the gallery it wouldn't appeal to me, but looking at it as a journalist, it raised questions, and I wanted to have those questions answered. Like, why do you make this?
Yeah.
It takes you down so many like just disparate paths.
So
and,
can
like,
I
little
like
cul-de-sacs.
I want to ask you another question.
Uh-huh.
Like, so my impression of the art world, and it's like partially through Twitter, and just partially through like sort of like by osmosis over the last 10 years. Like, I think the art world is, like, commercial. And I think the art world is, like, largely sort of adjudicated by these, like, weird satellite art fairs and, like, all... like, and so much of it I actually just don't understand.
Mm.
And, like, you've talked now to, like, a host of different kinds of artists.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have a sense of... who's doing the right thing and who's doing the wrong thing?
Not at all. I have no sense of right and wrong in any setting.
I guess that's a shitty question. I don't, maybe erase that. But I guess I mean like who like.
I judge.
No, hold on. Stop. So you're an artist too.
Yeah.
You're an artist too. Like why tell stories? Who's listening? How should we do this, man? You know what I mean?
That's a tough question for me to answer because you are big into the storytelling. I'm, as an artist, very much about iconicism and, like, the image as holding power, in a way. But,
give me an example.
Oh, well, like, in my most recent series, I'm, doing a lot of spray paint stencils of wildlife, and it's all based on just idealisms and longings for like the American West and the wilderness and
manifest destiny, bitch.
It's about like the understanding that it is an unrealistic fantasy. That
did you read Mason and Dixon?
No, what's that?
You should.
Okay,
it's a Thomas Pynchon book about Lewis and Clark's like. Journey across the American West. It's awesome.
Oh, sounds good.
Yeah.
But,
I'm going to buy it for you and send it to you.
Okay. But yeah, I'm just kind of doing that series, and they're made to sell. They're products. They're modular. I make them all the same size. I make them all spray paint stencils so that I can mass produce them.
Do people buy
them? Cheaply and efficiently. I'm trying to get people to buy them. You want to buy one?
Yes, yes. Okay. How much are they?
$30.
Oh my god, I have $30 in my wallet. Done. Who's like, is that why you interviewed me?
This is a really long con.
Really elaborate.
Yeah. Ryan and I are both going to buy one for you tonight. Just paid $60.
Yeah.
That's your Greyhound ticket back home, baby.
Who's that awesome artist who paints on the fiberboard? Bill Keane, is that his name?
Bill Keane's the famous circus guy.
Shit, it's not Bill Keane then. Miranda, if you're listening, call me and tell me what the name of that artist is. He did a bunch of, he just paints like the same painting like 25 times, and his whole thing is like democratization of art. Like, art is like, should be consumed, and it's because it's so difficult to produce, it becomes inherently so expensive. So his whole thing was like painting the same painting over and over again, and then just selling them for cheap.
Well, I come from a print background, so printmaking is all about democratization of artwork and trying to make it affordable to the common masses, and that's really where I'd like to push good art. Is I don't think the rich people should just hold it all for themselves.
You think like art, like everyone should have access to good art?
Yeah.
How, like,
I agree with that.
I mean, solve it.
What are you talking about?
I'm doing my best. But anyway,
how much is the game going to be,
Rob? The game?
Yeah.
Oh, download. Free. It's free. It's free. It's free. It's free. Of course.
There you go. Same thing.
Yeah.
Anyway, stylistically, the way that I approach this wilderness wildlife thing is hyper realistic, psychedelic, bright colors, patterns, and it's all about just like an icon that acts as a portal for. You can just like put it up in your room and you see it, and it just activates your brain in a way that gets you excited about the subject matter and gets you started thinking about like where that creature exists, and you want to be there and making it look appealing. And so while it has this whole like kind of the commodification of it is really like a byproduct, like it was a side thought afterwards, like, well, I like working in spray paint and I can use cheap materials so I can like mass produce.
I've been using a lot of spray paint,
but
yeah.
Just that's all spray paint.
Iconography. Yeah. That was what I was going for, so. I'm not good at concise answers, so.
Cheers. More comfortable. We're done. Medicine. We're done.
Finished.
Cheers. Okay. Nice job.
Thank you.
This episode of Studio Sessions with our guests Rob Andrews and Ryan McManus. You can find Rob's work online at andrewsautomatic.com. You can also learn more about me at my website, mattcoolman.com. If you'd like to support this program, you can send a donation through PayPal to studiosessionspodcast@gmail.com. Even if you only send $1, your donation helps guarantee I can continue providing interviews with interesting artists for your listening pleasure. And of course, don't forget to visit BigRedAndShiny.com for future episodes, along with other high-quality arts and culture content. Thank you for listening, and see you next time on Studio Sessions.